Hello and welcome to Power Play for this Friday, May 7th. I'm Joyce Napier. Coming up on the show, Trudeau's chief of staff testifies.
Who made the decision not to tell the prime minister?
What I was wanting to ensure was done to protect the complainant was that the proper next steps were taken. And that's what I did immediately, and that's what I took seriously. And then there was no more information to be had.
Katie Telford questioned on how the Prime Minister's office handled a 2018 allegation of misconduct against former Defence Chief General Jonathan Vance. Is the committee satisfied with her response? We'll bring in MPs in moments. Then, why won't Canada take a clear stand on vaccine patents?
We don't end this pandemic anywhere without ending it everywhere. That's why making sure that we are providing access to vaccines to countries around the world is not just in their interest, but in our own interest as well.
Trudeau says Canada is participating in World Trade Organization talks, but won't give away the government's position on lifting vaccine patents. What do the drug companies think will bring in Pfizer Canada's vaccine lead? Plus, free speech at risk? The government amends its Broadcasting Act, but are they protecting freedom of expression on social media? Professor Michael Geist joins with a fact check. This is Power Play. Let's get to the players.
Who made the decision not to tell the Prime Minister of a serious allegation against the Chief of the Defence Staff?
Madam Chair, at the time, what I was wanting to ensure was done to protect the complainant was that the proper next steps were taken. And that's what I did immediately, and that's what I took seriously. And then there was no more information to be had, as I've told you, except for the fact that I did get assurance that there was not a safety issue.
For the first time, we are hearing from the Prime Minister's Chief of Staff about what she knew concerning a complaint against the former head of Canada's military, General Jonathan Vance. Katie Telford's testimony before the House Defense Committee was frank. She claims she knew nothing about the nature of the allegation when it was brought to her attention in 2018. But why didn't the Prime Minister learn about the existence of this allegation? Let's bring in the MPs. Anita van den Belt is the Defence Parliamentary Secretary. James Bizan is the Conservatives Party Defence Critic. And Randall Garrison is the NDP's Defence Critics. Thank you to three of you for joining me. I know you just got off your committee. It was quite interesting. Good television. I'm in television. I can appreciate that. But before we started, we should remind our viewers that the Defense Committee has been investigating allegations against General Vance, allegations which he reportedly denies. James Bizan, I want to start with you because you tabled, your party tabled a motion this week to have Katie Telford fired. You heard her now at the Defense Committee. Do you still think she should be fired?
I think if you watch today's committee meeting, you'd see that it was obfuscation, that her testimony was conflicting with previous testimony that we heard from other members of the Privy Council Office, the Prime Minister's Office, and the former Defense Ombudsman, Gary Walborn. You know, and as you played, we asked Katie Telford a dozen plus times today, you know, who made the decision not to inform Justin Trudeau? And she says that she knew that these were serious allegations. She even makes the claim that she was satisfied that safety wasn't an issue. So how could you make that decision if you didn't know what was in the allegation? So it becomes completely unbelievable, and that they are involved in a cover-up and that she's complicit in this cover-up, along with a number of other witnesses that we've heard of, including Defense Minister Sajjan. So as we said today, and as we said in our motion earlier this week, that if she made the decision to not tell the Prime Minister about these serious allegations, whether they're sexual in nature or not, we have serious allegations against the top soldier of the land. And if she decided not to tell the Prime Minister, well, then she failed to do her job, and she was complicit in protecting the chief of defense staff, rather than making sure Prime Minister Justin Trudeau didn't put pen to paper and sign off on salary increases, pay at risk sign-offs, extending his contract as chief of defense staff, as well as leave Vance in charge of Operation Honor, which now is demoralizing our troops, you know, undermining confidence in leadership, especially our political leadership. So, yes, she should be fired because she didn't do her job. And Justin Trudeau, it comes back to him now, is if he doesn't fire Katie Telford, yeah, then that means that he was in the know the entire time. And maybe we need to hear from him at committee, too.
Okay, Anita Vanderbilt, Vandenbilt, I want to hear you because there are a lot of points that James Bazin made right here. So, you know, why Telford did not tell the Prime Minister? She was asked that question indeed many, many times, and her answer was not really clear. Why wouldn't you tell the Prime Minister? Let me put this in context. This is after a Supreme Court justice, you know, did an investigation into these allegations in the armed forces in 2016. There were 10 recommendations about it. This was at a time when Me Too was running all over the world, the Weinstein affair. So, you know, there was already a Me Too context. Why not tell the Prime Minister, listen, we may have a problem, Prime Minister?
No, thank you. And respectfully, I disagree with my parliamentary colleague's characterization of this. I think that Ms. Telford was very clear today that there was actually nothing to know at that time. And this actually is very consistent with the Clerk of the Privy Council, the Secretary to the Cabinet, with Elder Marquez and the Minister, who have all testified that they did not know the nature or the specifics of the allegations. And in fact, what we learned new today is that despite the fact that after giving it to the appropriate authorities, which was PCO, and despite the fact that the Clerk of the Privy Council came back to say that they were at an impasse because the person, we now know, and we're applying a lot of hindsight to this, we now know what kinds of allegations were there. What we didn't know at the time was even that what it was. We didn't know who the complainant was because Mr. Walburn didn't have permission.
Let me ask you this. But the ombudsman testified that he told them that it was these allegations were sexual in nature.
Ms. Minister Sajjan has made very clear that he disagrees with those aspects of the testimony. But nonetheless, it was treated as if it was the most serious allegation. It was acted on within hours, immediately. And when you don't have a complainant, you don't know the name, you don't know what the complaint is, even then, when the Clerk of the Privy Council said there was nothing further to do, what we learned today is that Ms. Telford, out of concern for the safety of the complainant, did have them go back to Mr. Walburn to get assurances, at least, if he couldn't tell the name or the nature of the complaint, that the person was not in harm's way. And that shows the level of commitment to the survivors. And what we're really, I think, at this point, what the committee needs to focus on is why it was that these survivors didn't feel safe to come forward, didn't want an investigation to begin.
And that's exactly. I understand that. But, you know, who knew what when? What we do know is that this complaint went nowhere. And, you know, Randall Garrison, you said something. I want to get Randall Garrison in here because he said something that struck me during the hearing, that this illustrates that there is no path for these complaints. Could you elaborate on that? Because it seems to be a perfect example of what has been happening so far in the Canadian Armed Forces. Somebody complains and it kind of nobody knew or kind of half knew, and what we knew at the time, what we know now. Mr. Garrison, is this what goes on in the armed forces every time a woman, or most of the time a woman, complains?
Well, this is quite often what happens. And we often hear the Liberals saying, well, the complainant didn't want to go forward. Oh, yes, she did. She went to the military ombudsman. What she didn't want is to be subject to retribution. But she did want her complaint to be taken seriously and there to be action on it. And we can go round and round the procedural swamp of who handed the hot potato to who and whose office. The fact remains at the end, there was no investigation and no action was taken against the highest officer in the Canadian military on an allegation of sexual misconduct. What does that do? that creates further fear that it doesn't do any good to come forward if you're a complainant, that you might just not get any action. And what does it do with perpetrators? It actually emboldens them because they know that they won't be held responsible.
I only have a 1 minute left, so I'd like to go around the table. And you guys are sitting on that committee. James Bazin, what would be your recommendation?
Well, look,
very quickly, I only have a minute.
But what we have right now is Katie Telford didn't answer the questions. Definitely there's something there that the Liberals are hiding. There's more evidence out there. So the committee still has to keep on looking into this. It's inherent upon us as members of Parliament to get the answers for our men and women in the Canadian Armed Forces.
Anita van den Bell, how about these women who have come forward?
I think the committee has a tremendous opportunity to actually focus on recommendations. And this is why we've put Madame Arbour and General Carignan, who's starting within weeks to create a reporting structure for oversight outside of the chain of command. And that is exactly what we should be focused on as a committee and not all of this partisan.
Randall.
I don't think there's any point in the committee repeating what Madame Deschamps recommended 6 years ago. What I'll be looking for is a way to restore trust, a trust in the military leadership and a trust in the political leadership. And until somebody takes responsibility for the failure to act against General Vance, and until there are consequences for senior military leaders, I don't think any further proposed reforms will be taken seriously.
And who's taking responsibility? Thanks. It's the perpetrators. It's the people who abuse their power to harm women. And there are ongoing...
There's a ministerial accountability. Prime ministerial responsibility.
Clearly, we all have opinions about this, but I get a feeling that you guys are going to meet again and we're going to follow it. And we may be talking again very soon. Anita van den Bell, James Bazin, Andel Garrison, thank you so much.
Have yourselves
a safe weekend.
Have a great weekend.
And we'd love to hear your thoughts on today's show and your leaders here in Ottawa. Please reach out through social media on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and email. And coming up, the international push to temporarily lift patents on COVID-19 is growing stronger. Dozens of MPs signed a letter urging the Prime Minister to support that call. But do pharmaceutical companies agree with a temporary wave? We put the question to Fabien Paquette, Pfizer Canada, next. Stay with us.
We know that we don't end this pandemic anywhere without ending it everywhere. That's why making sure that we are providing access to vaccines to countries around the world is not just in their interest, but in our own interest as well. That's why we are participating in these discussions and why we hope to get to a solution.
And welcome back. As Canada looks to start doling out the Pfizer vaccine to children 12 and up, a coalition of MPs from all five federal parties are urging the federal government to back the waiving of vaccine patents in an effort to expand global vaccine access. Just like the U.S. administration that made it very clear this week, they support waiving intellectual property protections for COVID-19 vaccine. The Canadian government has been less forthcoming about its position. It says it's ready to discuss the proposal of a waiver. But what does Pfizer make of the movement to waive the IP on their vaccine? Well, let's ask Fabien Paquette, the vaccine lead for Pfizer Canada. Welcome, Mr. Paquette. Welcome to Power Play. Very nice to see you. Thanks for being there. I'm wondering about pharmaceutical companies lifting these patent requirements. I know the debate is before the World Trade Organization, but what you're being asked, you and other obviously pharmaceutical companies, is to waive these protections or these patents just during the pandemic. Why not?
So, good afternoon, Joyce. Nice to be here. I think that we need to come back to the fundamental question, which is, what should we be doing to ensure that we have effective, safe, and reliable vaccines available around the world for people who need it? So that's the fundamental question that we need to come back to. And then the question is, what should be the best approach? And waiving IP protection is probably not the best one. What you want to ensure is that you can produce these vaccines in sites that could do it effectively, rapidly, with the resources that are being made available to do it.
Okay, so lifting the waiving the patent is not a solution. Give me one solution, because it will take years probably for certain countries to get all their people vaccinated. So you have a faster way of doing this?
Well, absolutely. I think that the approach that Pfizer has taken so far and other pharmaceutical companies are the ideal one, which is to ensure that you can produce in high quality, effectively, with significant volume vaccines by concentrating the manufacturings of these vaccines in major sites with a lot of experience, expertise, built with processes that engineers, scientists have put in place in actually record time. If you think about what we've done, mRNA technology was in there a year ago, and it took us, you know, with a lot of energy, a lot of resources, significant investments, and collaboration among industry members to achieve this. So, of course, you know, when you do this, you need to make sure that you can maintain that approach, and maintaining the ability to use our well-developed manufacturing capabilities will definitely ensure that we can produce higher volumes.
So let me ask you this. Would Pfizer consider, for instance, licensing their product for companies that have the capacity to do this?
Well,
without lifting
takes...
without a waiver of an IP, just, you know, licensing certain companies?
Well, we do some partnerships already to ensure that we can enhance our productions. This year, we're going to produce over 2.5 billion doses. And this is done through some collaborations. We have some partners in place. And we want to maintain that approach. And what we have done also is to enhance our own manufacturing capabilities. Next year, we're going to be producing 3 billion doses, if not more. So I think that by making sure that we concentrate the efforts and the resources, we need to keep in mind that, you know, just achieving, you know, this results requires that you can have access to raw material that is sometimes very specialized, very difficult to obtain. And I could tell you that every grams of the raw material that we're receiving are being used effectively to make these vaccines.
So I want to ask you this, Mr. Paquette, because there was a lot of speculation as to why Canada would not support, I think 90 countries do. And it was suggested by some analysts that, you know, maybe pharmaceutical companies would be irritated with Canada, and Canada relies uniquely on pharmaceutical companies for their supply. Would that anger a company like Pfizer if Canada were to, you know, sort of align with the United States and be in favor of lifting or of a waiver of these patents?
Well, you know, this is, Joyce, a decision that the country leaders are taking very differently around the world. We have heard about the U.S. administrations, but on the other end, you have the EU group, you have Germany, and even Japan that has raised their concerns from a different angle. And I think that Canada is probably looking at this and say, okay, what should be the best approach? And clearly we know that lifting these patents is not optimal short-term, mid-term, and longer-term. And I think that that's probably what they have in mind. And they want to continue to pursue the dialogue to find a reliable solution that could be effective for all countries involved.
Mr. Paquette from Pfizer Canada, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us.
Thank you, Joyce. Bye-bye.
And before we head to break, here are some news that you need to know. As we do every week, we must note that Canadians Michael Spavor and Michael Kovrig have been detained in China for 879 days. The businessman and former diplomat were detained in December 2018, shortly after Canada's arrest of Huawei CFO Meng Wanzhou on a U.S. extradition request. The Canadian government maintains the two are innocent and being arbitrarily held in retaliation for Meng's arrest. And coming up, legislation mandating judges receive training about sexual assault received royal assent 4 years after it was introduced. What changes would this bring to the courts? Rana Ambrose joins us next. Don't go away. And welcome back. In 2017, then interim conservative leader Rana Ambrose tabled a bill to mandate sexual assault law training for judges. It was unanimously supported in the House, but died in the Senate when Parliament was dissolved ahead of the 2019 election. The Liberals reintroduced their own version of that bill in February last year, but it died on the order paper due to last summer's prorogation of Parliament. The bill was revived in September, and it finally became law last night. Here's Rana Ambrose after she first tabled her bill in February 2017.
Given the unique tendency of these cases to expose personal and private information of those involved, which only adds to the trauma of the original alleged crime, I believe Canada's judicial system must take extra care to ensure the proper application of the law in the first place. This is about making our legal system fair for everyone involved in these very difficult cases. And this is about reassuring Canadians that should they ever seek justice in court in connection to a sexual assault case, that they will be dealing with a judge that is trained and equipped to oversee such sensitive matters in their courts.
And Rana Ambrose joins us now. Ms. Ambrose, thank you for being there. And I should say, rather, a belated congratulations.
Yay!
4 years. But the legislation you originally introduced is now the law of the land. What does that change in Canadian courts?
Well, what it does is it makes what we hope is that it will create more confidence in our court system, which unfortunately for women who or men who experience sexual assault, they have very little confidence. We know from surveys that 1 in 3 women will experience some form of sexual violence in their life, but only 1 in 10 will ever report it to police. And if you ask them why, they say it's because they have no faith in the court system. So when a judge makes a mistake or says something from the bench, like, oh, why didn't you just keep your legs together? Or why did you wear that skirt? Or things like that that happen, which should never happen, that just rattles everyone's confidence in our court system. So training and education is key to make sure that not only do they know the law very well when they're applying it, so they don't make mistakes, and then someone, you know, a victim would have to go through the system again, which is very difficult, and most of them just walk away, or that they don't say things in the courtroom that really, that are really, frankly, misogynistic, sexist, discriminatory, things that should never be said in the courtroom.
So why do you think it took so long to pass? Because that's 4 years.
Well, I'm just going to be really honest. It took a long time because there were very few, but a couple people that don't believe that the system needs to change. And it's unfortunate because our institutions, we need to have trust in our institutions. And the way we have trust in them is that they evolve to continue to reflect our social norms of our current culture and our current society. And a lot has changed around issues around sexual assault and how we treat victims and survivors with dignity, the kind of language that we use. And judges are no different. They have to be trained in this. They have to be sensitive to this. And then on top of that, we actually have judges sitting in courts overseeing the most complex cases, which are sexual assault cases, making just basic mistakes in law. That is unacceptable. So I hope that this creates more confidence and with more confidence, let's hope that we can get those numbers up and we have more people that are willing to come forward to tell their story and seek justice.
Yeah, but we're seeing, you know, we spent a long time today, just today, talking about sexual misconduct in the armed forces. Now, beyond this bill, what more can we do to change the law and to protect and to allow women from coming forward and feeling comfortable and protected when they come forward?
Well, first of all, when they come forward, something has to happen. I mean, with this military, this issue you're talking about right now, 1,000 women came forward. And from what I can see, nothing has happened yet to make them feel
like a change occurred or there was some accountability or transparency. So there was a process, but it doesn't feel like there was an end there. And so, when we commit to something, if there's recommendations, we need to implement them. We need to have more transparency. I mean, a lot of our institutions, just by their very nature, they're very opaque. Well, that can't be the way it is anymore in this day and age. We need to have transparency and accountability. And if someone comes forward, there has to be some kind of a process where they feel listened to, recognized, respected. And if there's a serious issue there, it has to be dealt with. And hopefully there's some independence to the process as well.
Rana Ambrose, congratulations, belatedly, but congratulations nonetheless, and thanks for taking the time to talk to us.
Oh, it was a team effort from the Prime Minister all the way through to all the sexual assault survivors that I work with. So kudos to everyone. Thank you for having me on.
Bye-bye. And while all eyes were on Katie Telford's appearance at today's National Defense Committee, the Canadian Heritage Committee was facing an impasse over Bill C-10, the government's controversial attempt to modernize the Broadcasting Act. Some experts say Bill C-10 would allow Canada's broadcast regulator, the CRTC, to have authority over people's posts on platforms like Instagram and YouTube. Even former heads of the CRTC have raised red flags about it. But the government says they have no intention to regulate user-posted cat videos, for instance, and are trying to regulate online streaming platforms like they do for traditional broadcasters. In response to the backlash, new government amendments put forward yesterday look to limit the authority of the CRTC on streaming platforms. The amendment would limit CRTC authority, for instance, by only allowing the regulatory body to ask these social media giants how much revenue they make in Canada, and letting the CRTC impose obligations that would make these companies contribute to a heritage fund, as well as promote and make Canadian content more available. But at this point, is Bill C-10 too malign to get enough support? Let's bring in law professor Michael Geist to weigh in. Welcome, professor. Welcome to Power Play. This is a complicated issue for a lot of people. Just trying to understand, is the government trying to, you know, to stop me from seeing those cat or dog videos? Heritage Minister Stephen Guilbeault said he would introduce amendments to make things crystal clear over controversial aspects of the legislation. Do these amendments make things more crystal clear to you?
I think they do make them more crystal clear, but what's now crystal clear is that the government is indeed regulating user-generated content on the internet. You know, when the Heritage Minister said he's going to make things crystal clear, he said he's going to make it crystal clear that this bill will not regulate or treat user-generated content as a program that would be subject by the broadcast regulator, the CRTC. But when those amendments came, there was nothing to stop that from happening. In fact, it's the government itself that previously excluded it. They created an exemption for user-generated content to be treated as a program. They took that back, and these amendments don't change that at all. They provide a little bit of comfort in terms of trying to circumvent some of the CRTC's powers. But at the end of the day, there are still some real powers that the CRTC has to influence what people see on their feeds on sites like TikTok, Instagram, and YouTube.
So what do you want to see? I mean, that sounds like a major intrusion and an unprecedented, actually, intrusion from the government. So what do you want to see?
Well, it is a major intrusion. In fact, there is no country around the world that I've searched that seeks to do this. Even the Europeans, which have pretty significant regulation when it comes to online video services, distinguish between services like Netflix that curate and have their own content as opposed to user-generated content or video sharing services, where they simply say, we're not going to get into the business of trying to regulate that sort of content and what people might see in their feeds. So a clear starting point, I think, is to say no to the approach the government is taking and provide the full exemption. I think they need clear thresholds so that this overbroad regulation that touches on services around the world, even that they may not have significant presence in Canada, need to be scaled back. And really, at the end of the day, I think there's so many fundamental flaws in this legislation that I join with some of the former chairs of the CRTC, who say that they need to go back to the drawing board and scrap this altogether.
you're in favor of scrapping it. In other words, it's not salvageable because now too many people think it's an intrusion. It should be scrapped and go back to the drawing board?
Well, I don't think it's just that. I do think it should go. We should go back to the drawing board. I think it's been a fundamentally flawed piece of legislation from the outset, made worse by the decisions that the government has made, and made even worse, I suppose, by their inconsistency and almost incoherence in trying to explain. But I think we could start from scratch. I think that with the government moving towards taxing some of the big tech companies, there's money there if we want to try to ensure that there's some immediate support for the creative sector. As it stands now, this bill, even if it were to pass, would be locked up in the courts and at the CRTC for years. Creators aren't going to see a dime until the latter half of this decade under this legislation. If there's urgency here, there are better ways of addressing that concern without moving into this kind of internet regulation that the government is thinking about.
And we'll see where it goes. I mean, these are not the last words. Let's see what the minister and what the government decides in the coming weeks. Michael Geis, law professor at the University of Ottawa, thank you for coming on. Have a great weekend.
No, thanks for having me.
And Telford testifies at the defense committee.
We know all this, Ms. Telford.
And that's what we did. You seem confused on it, so I wanted to clarify.
No, you guys dropped the ball is what's happened here.
Did the PM's chief of staff contain the scandal? We'll bring in our Friday strategy session after the break.
My question is, who decided not to tell the Prime Minister of the existence of an allegation against the General?
Madam Chair, through you to the member, I would just again say we didn't have any information about the allegation. We didn't know anything about it. It was something that all the appropriate follow-up was done through the appropriate people, and the appropriate people to do that follow-up was the Privy Council Office. And I believe the Privy Council has all of the required information also to inform the performance management process, which they also manage.
And welcome back. Did Katie Telford manage to contain a scandal fueled by these allegations that keeps threatening to boil over? The Prime Minister's Chief of Staff, Katie Telford, testified to the Defence Committee, about when she learned of an allegation levied against now-retired General Jonathan Vance. Telford testified that while she knew there was a complaint, she only learned it was a sexual misconduct allegation this year. So did Telford succeed in making her case, and did her testimony further the work to confront the crisis in the military? Let's bring in our strategist, Greg McCachran from Proof Strategies leans liberal. Adrienne Batra is the Toronto Sun's editor-in-chief. She offers up a conservative perspective. Anne McGrath is the NDP's national director, and Greg Weston from Earnscliffe Strategy Group has a non-partisan point of view. Hello, Strats. Happy Friday. Before we start, we should again remind our viewers that the Defense Committee has been investigating allegations against General Vance, allegations which he reportedly denies. Adrienne, let me start with you. Did Telford succeed in making her case? Has she contained this scandal? Or are people going to keep asking, why didn't she tell the Prime Minister and why did the Prime Minister not know?
So on the question with respect to whether this has been contained, I think it hasn't been. There are a number of inconsistencies with Ms. Telford's testimony today, and the questions will still be asked because now it's going to go back to the Minister of National Defense, Harjit Sajjan. Why didn't he do something? But the most obvious inconsistency we heard from Ms. Telford today was previous testimony had said that former General Vance did indeed get a pay performance bonus, almost a danger pay bonus back in 2018. That's prior to the end. And that's right around the time the allegations were made. And so there was an awareness. And where also Ms. Telford could have followed up with her colleague in the PMO who said he went to the Privy Council office to investigate this and that there were suggestions that this was of sexual in nature. So inconsistencies there overall. But from a former as a former political staffer, you know, there's obviously you sometimes don't want to tell. Right. I understand that there's plausible deniability and things like that. But when the prime minister is about to hand sign the vote performance bonus of the very top general in Canada, who is in charge of actually looking at sexual harassment allegations within the military and has a charge allegations against him, I think he'd be asking some questions.
And, you know, we still don't know why it took so long to find out what the nature of these allegations or this complaint was to come out. But what more information do you want to know? What question do you have after listening to Katie Telford about this case? What is it that that stuck to you?
So obviously there are a lot of questions still to be answered. I don't believe that Katie Telford was under any illusions that this was going to put an end to this. I don't think anyone thinks that that's the case. There are questions that need answers. At the same time, we know a lot. We know that there are hundreds and hundreds of women in the Canadian Armed Forces who have made complaints about sexual harassment and had absolutely no action taken on those. So I think that the question now is, okay, we all know, now what happens? And that is the responsibility of the Prime Minister and the Defence Minister. What action will be taken? Will, for instance, the recommendations of the Deschamps report be implemented? Or are they going to drag their feet and hope that they can kick this can down the road to after the next election with the new investigation? They have had an investigation. They have recommendations. We know that it was sexual harassment. We know that there's hundreds of women involved that have made complaints. What are we going to do?
Greg McCachran, you know, how is it that the Prime Minister wouldn't be told about these allegations? I mean, he is Canada's top general. Even if you don't know the nature of them, saying, you know, hey, we may have a problem, Prime Minister?
Yeah, frankly, I don't really care right now. I looked at that committee today. I'm inspired by a question, actually, that Rachel Aiello, who works in your bureau, asked Aaron O'Toole earlier this week when he was calling for Katie Telford's resignation. She asked him, how is this going to help the women in the military who have faced inappropriate behavior, harassment, sexual assault? So I watched that committee today through the same lens. What did that committee today do to help those women and some men? Not one bit. It's a political bun fight that Canadians are watching. And if you watch really carefully, you know that similar allegations were made when Prime Minister Harper appointed General Vance. The same process that I heard described today seemed to be used before. They send it to PCO. So what actually happened today? And will we actually remember this a week from now? The Conservatives seem to be really obsessed with having Katie Telford come to committee. They weren't really big on having their chiefs of staff appear, but it did nothing to address the problem. And I think that's, it was just today, it was a waste of time and a waste of money.
Interesting. Greg Weston, is the public paying attention? Do you agree with Greg McCachran, or is this going to hurt the Liberals?
So parliamentary committee is a gong show. This is not news. Parliamentary committees, sadly, and I say that sincerely, have not been designed in a long time to actually achieve anything other than political theater. It's just an extension of question period. So Conservatives came today and they probably already had not only their questions prepared, but their conclusions to Katie Telford's testimony were already, you know, pre-cant. That was pretty clear. So they're there to try to cast aspersions on the government, the opposition parties. The NDP did a pretty good job too. But when someone like Katie Telford, who is the probably the most senior person in the Prime Minister's office, agrees to appear as part of this process, she knows that her role there is going to be political too. And that is, first of all, to show up. Pretty well stamps out in most average Canadian minds that there's some cover up here.
Yeah.
But does it do anything to advance, get to the bottom of the real scandal? The real scandal is in the military. The real scandal is not really who knew what in this thing that seems to be going nowhere. And I think if you're an average Canadian watching this, say, okay, how about you get in and start fixing what is really an ugly problem in the military?
Yeah.
Right on.
Yeah.
I'm with Greg
on
this.
You start helping those, how about you start helping those women? I'm going to have to take a break, Strats, but we'll be right back. Stay with us. More voices join the global call for intellectual property patents to temporary lift on COVID-19 vaccines. But Canada hasn't added its name to the cause. Why is the federal government holding back? Our strategists dig up, dig in next. We'll be right back. And welcome back. No one is protected until everyone is protected. That's what the Prime Minister said today. We've heard it from our leaders throughout this pandemic. So why is the federal government dragging its feet on the international calls to temporarily lift intellectual property patents on COVID-19 vaccines? Now, dozens of MPs of all political stripes penned a letter to the Prime Minister calling on him to support this initiative. The U.S. supported it early this week. Will this persuade Canada to join the global chorus? Let's bring back our strategists, Greg McCachran, Adrian Batra, Anne McGrath, and Greg Weston. Welcome back. Adrian, let me ask you, why is Canada hesitating?
That's a fantastic question. There's no reason for us to be hesitating. I know this word is overused and has been for the past nearly year and a half is when we say unprecedented, but certainly this is yet again another unprecedented situation where you have almost unanimous support by all parties in the House, including 30 Liberal MPs who want Canada to sign on to this. I don't understand why the PMO continues to, you know, really drag their heels. But this is one of those very significant moves where we know we can't get back to our regular lives. And this is truly a global issue. And part of Canada wants to be, we should be at the forefront. We should be leading and getting alongside with our friends like the United States and other countries who have said that we will be supportive of lifting the patents. It just makes sense.
Greg McCachran, why do you think Canada has taken that position? I'm wondering if they're going to change it because the United States surprised everybody at the G7 in London this week and said, OK, we're in favor of lifting these patents anyway for COVID-19. Will Canada follow suit now that the U.S. is doing it?
Joyce, I think you've hit the catalyst. The U.S. decided to do that. Why? The U.S. is hitting pretty soon. Everyone who wants to be vaccinated will be. They'll have a challenge with vaccine hesitancy, of course, in the United States. So now that they've reached that point, they want to have that discussion. I want to read into the details a little bit more. The United States has basically, as I read it, agreed to review the details and discuss at the WTO. That's not a done deal yet. So I think we should still continue to watch that.
But Anne, the United States said to that they respect, you know, intellectual property, but, you know, it's extraordinary times, extraordinary measures. Do you think Canada fears retaliation from big pharmaceutical companies because we are 100% reliant on them?
I think that's the elephant in the room, Joyce. I think that there has to be a lot of pressure on the Prime Minister to stand up to the big drug companies and get on side with all of the other countries that are doing this, for both for humanitarian reasons and also for the reasons that Adrian outlined about, which is basically enlightened self-interest. This is something that must be done, and the Prime Minister has to stand up to those big drug companies, and so far he's been unwilling to do that.
Even the conservatives, Greg Weston, are in favor of it. It seems there seems to be a coalition in Parliament of Canadian MPs who think that it's time for Canada to get on board. Why do you think Canada is hesitating?
Well, I think part of the reason Canada is hesitating, Joyce, and I hate to be the one to burst the bubble here, but Canada just isn't a player in the vaccine industry. We know that. We've been completely dependent on vaccines from elsewhere. So the most obvious fact of this thing is that Canada can give away, agree to give away IP. It's not giving away IP that comes from this country. So Canada is going to line up with whatever the United States decides to do. And the United States right now, with a Democratic party in power, there's a lot of politics taking place there. There's a lot of friction between the pharmaceutical industry and some leading Democrats. So they'll hash all that out. But it's not going to make any difference one way or another to Canada, whether we agree or not. And it's certainly not going to make any difference to the world. And the fact of the matter is that giving away the IP is actually not the way we're going to get needles into the arms of the developing people in the developing world and elsewhere. It's an incredibly complicated process that goes into vaccines, and just simply handing them a magic formula doesn't mean that some country in Africa can turn around and start churning out a batch of vaccines. It doesn't happen that way. The way we are going to vaccinate the world is for countries like the United States that are producing it to supply it to the rest of the world, and for Canada to contribute its money and expertise in making sure those countries get it into the arms of the people who live it. That's the simple thing. The IP thing is kind of a distraction.
Yeah, and I asked Pfizer today whether the company would consider licensing their product for certain companies so they could produce it. Look, this is going to be a very long conversation, and in front of the World Trade Organization, no conversation is ever short. So Greg McCachran, Adrian Batra, Anne McGrath, and Greg Weston, thanks for being there. For you ladies, happy Mother's Day on Sunday.
Have yourselves a wonderful weekend, and we'll see you next week.
And that's your Power Play Day in Politics. Thank you for joining us. We'll be back right here on Monday. Happy Mother's Day to all those moms. Have a safe and happy weekend.